Welcome back. I trust you had a pleasurable time with your coffee and biscuits. It is, you know, quite a pleasure to introduce our next set of speakers. In fact, a lot of pleasure for me today. However, this is going to be the great way to start after the break. Before you, the two gentlemen are European Alternatives. They're an independent, cultural and political organization. And you know, they are fairly dedicated to finding means of addressing debate and how a particular form of debate can emerge. Internationalism, again, forms a part of what they do, being that they're based in London, Paris, and Bologna. They publish a monthly magazine, and so travel and text, those kind of new alternatives about how to address the future. And I suppose at that I will leave them to do their thing.
Thanks very much. So Lorenzo, did you hear about the extradition flights leaving from the UK and France just last week? A chartered flight, chartered by the UK, went and collected a certain number of Afghan illegal immigrants, and then went on to Paris and, in fact, I think it was Lille rather than Paris, and collected a certain number of French people living in France, Afghans living in France, despite the French government, in fact, saying that the chartered flights would be cancelled. There's actually campaigns already running about that. Ted Asile, for example, in France, are protesting. I wonder if you heard anything about it.
I think it's important to stress that the situation that we're facing in Europe today concerning migration, and that is also a subject of today's conference to a good extent, is in any possible sense of the term extremely serious. We're always reminded that one of the great achievements of the European Union or the project of European unification was to pacify the continent, to stop a war between brothers, between European countries. And certainly that was successful, but we're now faced with a situation whereby constant violation of human rights and also actual deaths of human beings are the order of the day. The deportation that you mentioned is nothing too new. We all know that in Italy, in Greece, in Athens, quite regularly migrants commit suicide in detention centers. Only a few weeks ago, several swallowed razor blades in a detention center near Rome. Several tried to hang themselves in Lampedusa. The situation in Athens is very close to this to the deportation that you mentioned. Following the results of European elections in June 2009, which saw a strong affirmation of the radical right wing in Greece, a central neighborhood of the country, of the city of Athens, which was crowded by migrants, legal or otherwise, has essentially been the theater of sweeps, which remind us of something that occurred in this continent 50 or 60 years ago. Migrants were essentially loaded on trucks and brought into detention centers, the conditions of which we all know. These are the places where people commit suicide eventually, because it's 100 people sleeping in a place that fits 20. So I think the stressing the unacceptability of this situation, the quite clear violation of human rights, is something that that should motivate us all to take quite a strong action concerning this.
There's a question of exactly what the action should be, not least at a European level, because if I understand correctly, with the situation in Greece, for example, the German government, or at least the previous German government, refused to send migrants to Greece, to send them through Greece, because they didn't have any faith that they would be treated according to human rights. One might wonder why they only applied that to Greece and perhaps not to Italy, for example, or various other countries. And so there's this quite familiar to people like us who take an interest in European affairs, this familiar hypocritical attitude between the nation states and the European level. And if one's to pose the question what should be done, it's really how to negotiate that that border, and I think it's important to appreciate that the border is quite multiple in Europe. There's borders of Europe. There's also a border to Europe, even for European citizens, which passes by the nation state level. And there's this space of potential hypocrisy and negation, which takes place at the nation state level. Then there's also a whole series of other borders which segregate the society and actually divide it internally as well as externally.
I think it's very important, especially given the title of the conference, to, as you say, not fall into the assumption that the border is only one and it's the border between, in this case, the European Union and what's external to it. Especially for what concerns the migration into Europe, what we're faced is exactly a multiplication of borders by which we no longer have the old territorial understanding of the border, whereas people are either outside or inside, and once they're inside, they share and take part in a certain space of civil rights, a space of political rights. But we have an essential inclusion through exclusion within the European soil itself. It's extremely interesting to notice that, for example, in the north of Italy, the regions governed by the Lega Nord, which is quite often accused of being one of the most xenophobic parties that we have in Europe today, these same regions are actually the regions where migrants, according to the standards that are laid out by several migrant agencies, are actually the most integrated in societies. Are the regions where most migrants work, where most migrants have a house, rented or owned. And what does this mean? It means that we're faced with a situation whereby even when the border is passed, the external border of the Union, we have a system that includes these migrants in a subordinate position. So it's a hierarchical inclusion in a certain sense. It's making use of the fact that migrants do cross the border quite often. The idea of a fortress Europe is very misleading in this sense, because the fortress has holes all around it, and there are hundreds of thousands of migrants who cross that frontier quite regularly. And this is, in a certain sense, accepted, in a certain sense, made use of, and exploited economically. It's exploited economically in agricultural harvesting, and it's also exploited in one of the most industrialized regions of Europe, such as the north of Italy, where the fact that we have this second class of citizenship that the migrant already in Europe represents is actually made use of to restart a process of labor exploitation that we thought, that we hoped, we had left behind with the development of the welfare state, with the development of a different approach to labor over the course of the 50s and 60s and the after-war period. So it's important to understand that effectively we're not talking about one border dividing the 27 states from what is outside of it, but we're talking about a plurality of invisible borders that radically transform our own approach to what human dignity means. Human dignity in terms of survival of migrants, human dignity in terms of the lifestyle that they carry, but also the dignity of labor, which was one of the greatest conquests of the past, and now it's being jeopardized.
Seems to me that in that case there, it's a good question to ask how useful the analogy of a border is to try and understand the situation. Because clearly it's difficult to get it beyond the geographical signification. And one can insist on the analogy to such an extent that one says, well, in fact, the borders are multiple and so on and so forth. But at a certain moment, particularly in a year where we're thinking a lot about walls and the anniversaries of them and so on, and that whole discourse is being reappropriated to a certain extent once again by those who have a particular
89
vision, 89 I mean, who have a particular vision of democracy and what liberty means, which perhaps is not certainly not the one I would share. But in a year where all of those analogies are being taken over, one wonders how useful borders is, and perhaps another way of thinking of the question would be, for example, who is a migrant? Because one thing that was implicit in what you were just saying about northern Italy is that in fact some of the areas where the greatest apparent xenophobia is expressed is some of those areas where the migrant has been most greatly integrated, I guess, might be one potential way of expressing that. And if one wants to try and go beyond the situation where that one's trying to express when one says that there's a border to Europe or there's multiple borders of Europe. What one's actually trying to do is to generate a new vocabulary in which those borders are no longer important. And perhaps a way of starting to do that is to ask the question, who is a migrant, and insist on the questions to such an extent that, in fact, one's no longer talking in terms of who is a migrant, who is not a migrant, but one goes beyond the very question of who is who, if you like.
Maybe it's a very old-fashioned term. You know, it's one that I like, but would the term of exploitation serve a purpose here? Because what we have is a system, is essentially a system of gain of European citizens, those who hold a European passport, who quite factually, quite materially benefit from the presence in their lands of a underclass that works and labors under conditions of clear exploitation, under conditions that no European citizen could accept, even if he wanted, he could not legally accept them. And also there is a certain twisted rhetoric that European countries often seem to carry through, which is to say that we and this connects to your idea of who is a migrant, we tend to push this dichotomy between the migrant and the citizen, seeing ourselves as a unified, homogeneous space which receives from the outside certain people who are not members of our community, who have no direct link with our community, who have no political, social, economic relations with our communities, but who come to our communities because they need help, because they come from countries which are at war, which are poor, underdeveloped, et cetera, et cetera. And this is where also the dichotomy between us and them, citizens and migrants, develops. There is this extraneity, this foreignness of the migrant who comes into Europe and who is then exploited for the benefit of the Europeans. But even before the migrant comes into Europe, I think if we look at the conditions that make a citizen of another country a migrant into Europe, they make a citizen of Morocco a migrant into Europe, it's possibly interesting to note that these are not very foreign conditions. It's possibly interesting to note that it's wrong for us to act as if we were faced with the baffling arrival of men and women to whom we can respond with benevolence or charity, if we so please, or whom we can return to their countries, such as the flights of the deportations that you mentioned today are representatives of. But then if we go and look at the ways that our own countries and the European Union and the different European states actually manage, carry on an economic system of global exploitation, if you allow me to use this term again, we possibly notice that there is a lot of connection between the citizen that becomes a migrant and the citizen of Europe even before these two figures actually meet one another. There was recently a resolution passed at the European Union level, which gave the jurisdiction of the water just outside of Senegal to Spain, because the Canary Islands, of course, are very close. What that meant was that fishermen from Senegal, who made their living by fishing outside of the deep waters of Senegal, were suddenly prohibited from doing so, because that became Spanish territory. These fishermen became unemployed. A large amount of those fishermen tried to migrate to the Canary Islands, enriching these armies of migrants. The example can be replicated if we go and look at the way the multinationals that find their headquarters in Europe behave when they go to the countries from which the migrants then come. And there is possibly also a big ethical problem when we realize that from the system of exploitation, from the fact that Spanish as opposed to Senegalese fishermen can fish in those waters, that a Italian or a French or a British company is actually allowed to pay miserable wages in a country of the third world, that this actually is to our benefit. If we're able here to come to a conference and pay the money the conference costs and pay all the organization that even our own artistic Western circus needs and necessitates, there is possibly a twisted link between the exploitation of this system of center and periphery and the wealth and the well-being that the European space produces annually. So to conclude, and maybe a slightly controversial note, it's our own benefits, our own position of economic supremacy that depends on the exploitation of these people when they're in Europe, but also before they come to Europe.
That seems to me to be pretty right, and it's a conclusion we come to when we talk about a great deal of issues, which is one of the reasons why sooner or later, Lorenzo, either we fall out or we stop talking about the issue and start trying to decide what ought to be done about it. Mm. And it seems to me that particularly difficult in this case of migration, and we've been throwing around the idea of running a campaign on migration or migrant rights, or at least trying to address the problem in some way or another, posing the question, what should be done and who should it be done with or who should it be done to? There's this particular problem of reinforcing the separations that one's trying to deal with and address. That's particularly noticeable with one of the many ideas that we had, which is to use the new provision in the Lisbon Treaty that was recently passed, to get technical about it, for Citizens Initiative, 1 million signatures from throughout Europe, and you can oblige the European Commission and the European Council to consider a certain issue. So you say, okay, let's have 1 million signatures about migrant rights, and then you think, well, are you going to ask the illegal migrants themselves to sign the petition? Would that count? Would they be happy to sign it? Do we start two petitions, 1 million worth of citizens and 1 million worth of migrants? How do we address the problem? And of course, it's much more serious than that, because it comes right down to this question of actually, how do you establish a solidarity and an identity between people who are exploited in this country and may or may not be citizens, and people who are exploited in the rest of the world and may or may not be citizens? And that's precisely the danger of launching something under the name of migrant rights or under the name of bordered Europe and so on. And it's precisely the conditions that one has to try and get beyond. And it may be that one has to go back to these slightly old-fashioned terms of exploitation and labor. But we all know their shortcomings as well. Not least that it's not at all clear. It's not at all clear in a lot of situations where the exploitation is taking place, who's doing the exploiting, notably if people are unemployed or if they're in out of employment. These terms get lost. So the question comes down again to, how do we stop speaking in this rather plush room and start acting?
And avoiding to recreate the opposition between migrants and citizens is also, there's also the positive dimension of it, of avoiding to think of ourselves as the good-natured people who think that migrants should have all the rights that they should have, and we militate against the evil-natured people, instead try and exploit migrants. Firstly, because it is not true that there are so many evil-natured people who actually want to simply exploit migrants and push them out of the European borders. These are people who respond to a demand that is being posed by the citizens of Europe of protecting their gains or protecting their lifestyle. And also because the same good-natured people should also realize, we should realize, that we are very much in connivance with this system. So this is also the cultural dimension that suddenly comes in, is realizing both our own position as political or cultural practitioners within a system that makes ourselves part of the problem. We're not simply outsiders who militate for the good cause. We're not good Samaritans. And to open up this is probably also where a certain cultural artistic commitment can come in. To raise an example of something that we did recently and are still doing in Athens, where there is this quite clear urban segregation between two or three central areas of the city, which were undergoing quite a classical process of gentrification. Galleries, studios, trendy cafes, and then suddenly, with the rapid increase of the migrant population in the city of Athens, the same neighborhoods suddenly collapsed. They suddenly became places full of illegal migrants. They became places of drug dealing. They became places of prostitution. The gentrification process stopped. The galleries that opened moved a few streets to the left. A few bars closed down. Some architectural studios moved. And this became the place where, after, as I began saying, after the recent European election, the right wing is trying to make a show of force by sweeping out these migrants. And you have a city within the city which is suddenly out of reach for the Athenians. you have the city outside of this inner city, which becomes out of reach for the migrants who instead live in this inner city. And one way that at least we found of addressing this problem was to precisely break this dichotomy, which was evident even in the discourse of progressive Athenians, of progressive Greeks, this dichotomy between that neighborhood and the rest of the city, by going into this neighborhood and actually engaging in quite a fruitful conversation with the people who started inhabiting this neighborhood, ranging from the Pakistani fruit seller to the unemployed illegal migrant who is lying down on the street. And what came out was that it's an extremely interesting wealth of different positions. For example, the simple fact of the gentrification of the neighborhood, we discovered, was perceived more as a threat by the Pakistani shopkeeper than the sudden influx of illegal migrants and drug dealing, because the gentrification process was risking to send him into the periphery of Athens, whereas the situation now is one that he's relatively comfortable with, or that can realize his own potential within. There was a wealth of voices coming up, a diversity of voices coming up of the residents of this new neighborhood, which drew a completely different picture from what initially the people that we interviewed and we spoke with believed was the situation, which was really black and white, good and bad. And this was certainly a research process, but was also an artistic process in that it was accompanied with videos, with interviews, with photography, and the whole outcome of this research is going to be placed on show in about a week's time in Monastiraki Square, which is one of the central squares of Athens, to open up this closed ghetto to the rest of the city, to present its diversity, to present also its liveliness, its humanity. And here we go back to maybe a fundamental question, because this idea of developing a common humanity, developing the awareness that if on the one hand we are involved in this process of exploitation from which we benefit materially, perhaps not all of us, but some people certainly do, a majority certainly does, if this is true, what needs to happen is to rework our relation to the other, to firstly understand where we stand within the system, as citizens of Europe, and then to understand our moral duty to deconstruct a system that is based on these contrapositions.
I think the deconstruction is the crucial point, and it's worth emphasizing that this project that you're talking about, of course, we're not only doing it in Athens, we're also doing it in Zagreb and in Belgrade and in London. And hopefully later on in Paris as well. And people tend to say to us when we invite them along, well, what on earth do all those cities have in common? And in a certain way, that's precisely the point, is that the exclusion and the borders, if you want to phrase it like that, might be expressed in a very site-specific way in each of the different places. But precisely what we're doing by engaging in very diverse cities is to multiply and to mix the awarenesses of the different kinds of exclusion, the different kinds of borderedness, to work at both the site-specific level and also the more universal level. And that can only be done by introducing a kind of mixity, which is transnational.
Thank you both very much for both a captivating format, but quite an in-depth study of a present condition. However, I will start off with a question while you're ruminating out there. And so I'm going to stress your position slightly, in that there is an assumption that the immigrant is working class, that their position in society is one of the underbelly. So you're linking of migration to prostitution, to drug dealing, to a particular comfortable position when the Pakistani or the Bangladeshi or Pakistani shopkeeper was much more comfortable with the migrant than with gentrification. This assumes that the migrant doesn't, in their own process, their own presence, bring about a form of gentrification in itself, which often happens. So if you just start from that position, so kind of a reversal, as I said, a stressing of your positions.
Firstly, speaking in London about this, it's extremely interesting, because the anthropology of migration in the United Kingdom and in other European countries is actually strikingly different. especially when you compare the anthropology of migration here from southern European countries. There is certainly a geographical situation. England is quite far away in the north. It's extremely difficult to get here for first arrival migrants who instead find themselves in Spain, in Italy, or in Greece, or in Malta. And there is also a question of a heightened security that this country certainly still possesses when compared to other border countries. In order to reach here, migrants have to pass at least two security controls, that of the Schengen area of the European Union, and then that of the United Kingdom, which is not part of the Schengen area. So there is a kind of a filtering process of the migrants coming into the UK that makes the migration here extremely, in a certain sense, almost more middle class to some level than the one that we find in a city like Athens or like Rome, where we have at least 1 million undocumented migrants, in Italy in this case, who have arrived in a matter of 2 weeks, 1 month, 2 months before, without speaking the language, without having any access to services, without having any even family contacts, whereas the migration in London is very much based on family contacts. And that creates a certain level of poverty which is more pronounced than you can see in a city like London. Then, of course, yeah, sorry.
The second quick point, though, is that one of the dangers with our captivating format, as you kindly put it, is that basically myself and Lorenzo do this every day anyway, talking with each other, and we use a kind of shorthand. And one of the dangers of the shorthand is when we refer to migrants, because we're often talking about the specifically European context. What happens with European citizenship, of course, is that the people who get into real problems are people who don't anymore have a permit to stay in Europe. And the reason they lose their permit to stay in Europe is because they lose their job, or they never had a job. And so very quickly, one's only talking about that class of society who's lost their job and lost their ability to have a permit to stay.
Okay, so just open. So, question. To the front, here. See the microphone, pardon. You can make your questions brief.
Yeah, I will make it really brief. Okay. It's just to say that I find it really important to actually incorporate class in the discussion like you were doing. And it's something that has been absent from most discussion in this country. And if I have to think back through my Portugal, it's something that came after the revolution of 1974, where you had the left represented and engaging in a dialogue with the working class, engaging intellectuals in experimental projects where these sort of issues were being debated. So I don't think it's just about talking about the other, mm-hmm. like you were suggesting that, you know, there was some romanticism and a distancing. But I think what's happening here is the opposite. It's a convergence like we had we've experienced it before in the south of Europe, in Portugal namely, this dialogue between the intellectuals or the technicians in certain, in architecture or in urbanism, engaging with the working class.
Okay. Would you like to respond?
Let's perhaps hear a few more voices.
Okay.
And then we'll...
Migrate to the front. Sorry.
Just a very quick... question / observation. You said, oh, we need to stop speaking and start acting. And I kind of sort of got curious about that because I want to ask what do you mean by acting? Not, you don't mean theatrically acting? What is an act and is speaking acting? You know, because often there is a sense of like, we need to get out there and, you know, fix the world. So I wondered... You know, I mean, I know you're involved in a lot of debates, and that is a form of action, but maybe just a small reflection on that.
I think speaking can be a form of action. It depends a little bit on where one is speaking and who one's speaking to. And I guess whether my speaking here is a form of action will be judged much more by what you do afterwards rather than what I say right now. But... precisely one of the things we wanted to try and do is to encourage people to think about what should be done, to put it in famous words. And there are various things that might be done, notably trying to go and persuade various levels of political power that exist to do things differently. And I think there's a tendency in these kind of occasions, or at least or at least perhaps occasions with these kinds of people, and to underestimate the potentials for actually changing people's minds amongst the decision makers and amongst the supposedly nasty people who have the power, so to speak. Not least because on issues like this, there's a great deal of people in decision-making positions actually puzzling over what should be done. And one of the things I'd certainly like to see is conversations like this being very much more joined up with conversations that are going on amongst the people who actually make the decisions.
If I can very quickly add to this, I mean, the campaign that Nicola mentioned at the beginning is an attempt that we launched in November to stimulate precisely transnational support for one simple demand that we will raise with the European Commission concerning migration legislation. That demand is being formulated now, so I will not state it because it's going to change. But it is to precisely have a political action. What we're very much hoping to do and to build now, and this is the reason of the program in Athens, in Zagreb and Belgrade, is not to have this just as a political campaign, collecting signatures on the street and stimulating NGO support, etc., but also directly involving artistic practitioners in the campaigning itself. Not simply having a stand that collects signatures, but having a intervention in a city that serves to both sensibilize, and this is where ads power is extreme, sensibilize the audience to the issue of the campaign, and also make the campaign a joining of forces between sectors that usually don't necessarily communicate, the institutional, the political or intellectual, and the artistic. And okay. This is what we'll try to do in November.
Okay. Well, great. And this problem that by the time the questions start coming, it kind of... But so one more question. I know there are more than one hand, but... One, there was a lady here who was, sorry, okay, the lady to the, not the person I pointed to, but hey, welcome to democracy. Go ahead.
Okay, all right. I was thinking as you spoke about Kevin Robbins's work on transculturalism, talking to him about the way in which different migrant groups with the mobility of labour now have different kinds of takes on their demands in the way in which certain communities are now much more self-contained and have set up systems of self-regulation and that are very different from the kind of, because both my parents came from other places, very different from the migrations of previous eras. And I wondered if you are reflecting the different types of demands of different types of migrant communities, or whether you or what your bottom line is essentially.
I think one of the things that we're pretty clear about with when we talk about transnationalism is that what it can't be is a kind of disguised form of multiculturalism. And there are these phenomenons of various migrant groups and other groups establishing forms of autonomy and autonomous systems independently of one another and of the wider society. And it's perfectly understandable and indeed desirable in the short term that should happen. But it can't be, as in your words, the bottom line. It has to be that one works to establish a society which is ever more universal rather than works to strive for a society which is ever more particular. And that's what we mean by transnationalism.
And any final words?
Maybe instead of my voice, we can hear somebody else's voice. Is the words I am.
Okay, in that case...
No, well, fine. The final word is to. No, we also have a tendency to work a little bit more on undocumented migrants, not settled communities, but migrants who are newcomers to Europe. The final word is an exhortation to please not just think that by simply feeling good discussing these issues, one is at peace with oneself. But these are real problems, and the expression of European apartheid for what is going on today in Europe concerning migration is real and accurate, and that requires a popular movement to change this.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our next speaker for this session is Vinca Crook. Now, I am much more inclined to describe her as Metahaven, being that when an individual represents a body, it is fairly interesting to see how an individual, and I suppose, especially within this context, how an individual and a body relate to each other. So I would describe Metahaven. Metahaven is a design studio based in Amsterdam and Brussels. They explore the ruptures in the field of design and research. They also, I mean, judging from their website, which hopefully some of you have already visited or will visit afterwards, try to produce alternative forms of expression. So it's on one hand, it is wholly familiar, the forms that they use, but the context within which it is placed complicates this situation rather. Okay. And they have a number of publications, and this include White Knight, and let's see, Unstoppable Identity. Well, I suppose at that rather pausing point, I will stop and let Metahaven do their thing.
Unstoppable Identity, that's great. It's actually Uncorporate Identity, which is quite a difficult term, but maybe after my talk today, maybe could be a little bit more clear. I'm going to read a text because I think it's much more clear when I read it rather than I speak from the top of my head. Where's this? So the title of our talk, I'm talking on behalf of all three of us, Daniel van der Velde and Gonzi Froni are my colleagues. Two of us, me and Daniel, are graphic designers and Gonzi an architect. So the title of our talk is European Identity, Loose Cohesion. So today, and that is me on behalf of all three of us, I will present some thoughts on European visual identity and how this is one, on the one hand, something that has gone past the point of design, and how, by looking closely in what happens in Europe, we can inspire a design based on another than centrally organized structure as we know it. So I'm going to speak in two parts, and the first part is European identity as a laissez-faire project. So I'm just gonna go quickly through a few notions on the EU. The European Union is an infrastructure, a framework which has enabled Europe to exist in practice, yet it has not made it especially meaningful. Europe's founding vision was not to build an extra large nation state, but to create a protocol for supranational collaboration. The Council of Europe adopted a blue flag with 12 yellow stars designed by Arsène Heitz. It became the flag of the European Union, which is this one. In the post-war years, Europe became an abstract and futuristic endeavor associated with progress. For example, the Eurostyle, or Eurostile, typeface designed by Aldo Novarese was drawing on the technical form Migrogramma as used by architects and engineers. Perhaps Europe was a streamlined ideal, like the Lotus Europa sports car you see here, manufactured in the UK in the early 70s. Memory could come to the aid of this abstract European utopia by providing an extensive repository of reliable historical figures like composers, writers, scientists, politicians, as well as battles and cities even. But despite recent calls for new European symbols, monuments and rituals, Eurostyle has now become Eurotrash. Since the 1990s, the Euro prefix has become a supranational indicator of discount pricing, transportation, and mobility. In early 2009, with the financial crisis spreading, the Netherlands were stricken by an advertising campaign produced by the global fast food chain McDonald's, which centered on the euro prefix. The campaign made a terrific and terrifying point. McDonald's hamburgers, an American invention, were shown in an unappealing plain design under the caption Euro Knaller, indicating their discount pricing. The Euro prefix, while in theory an all-purpose promoter of the idea of Europe, in practice designates various standardized prefab products which are always, first and foremost, cheap. Mozzarella di bufala is never Euro cheese. Coppa di Parma will not be known as Euro meat. Regulations now protect the local and regional denominations of almost every type of food, but the Euro prefix is freely employed to say discount. Euro brands do not designate particular values, historical ideas, or loyalties. They point at Europe, but they do not say what it is. They may be the European equivalent to Robert Venturi's Learning from Las Vegas, the book which decisively integrated commercial graphics and roadside buildings into American architecture. Likewise, it is possible to take the Euro brand seriously and examine what they say about design. So just to repeat, in 3 points, European brands are characterized by, first, an identity without a center. There's no identity that centrally distributes or controls the Euro brands. If these brands are probably correctly seen as indicators of Europe, they do so with only a very minimal reference to Europe's central symbols, like the European Union flag. An identity without a program, a brand without a center. And some very interesting examples of Euro brands you can find when looking at trucks driving through Europe. Here are some examples we came across while driving from Amsterdam to Stuttgart via Brussels. And some of them are more beautiful than others. Another characteristic of the Euro brands is that they're open source. The Euro brands make open source use of the European stars as a shared standard, like here. This is a good example, I think. Even the flag that has been called symptomatic for Europe's iconographic deficit has, through decades of repeated usage, become widely known. Advocates of Europe as a space of democratic values and humanistic principles see their flag back on shampoo packaging, pizza boxes, travel coaches, and hairdressers. The adaptation of the Euro prefix and the stars has been an open source affair. Another characteristic is that they're generic. The Euro brands establish a lowest common denominator in terms of spatial distribution and pricing. They may not be beautiful, but everyone knows them. This is especially noteworthy as the financial crisis undercuts the liberal dream of the market and the socialist dream of the safety net. The goods which have the least of surplus value are the goods named after Europe. As it were, an antithesis to Louis Vuitton and Gucci, Euro means generic. So I'm just also skipping the reference here to the Euro banknotes, which I think are, can come back to later, but I don't think it's so important in this discussion. So the next part is European identity and borders. So far, we have looked at the Euro brands as an unrecognized sphere of European pop art. There were brazen ambitions and high ideals, but we got Euro shopper, Euro paint, Euro drink instead as tangible European symbols. But also Eurostar trains and Euroline buses and Euronews television. Despite all the connections, Europe is not a singular or monolithic entity. Expressions like archipelago or island suggest that there may be a relation between Europe's urban geography and its social, political, and cultural conditions. Inside of Europe, you find new separations. Many European cities display inner borders between quarters where social, cultural, and religious groups which switch from self-perceived minority to majority and back. This is partly because of the way cities have expanded from their historical centers. The division between center and periphery is a given in their urban geography, but those borders can be enhanced or lessened by their reproduction in the media. The formation of identity is always in process. The identity of a city, a country, a region, or a people can never be forever fixated, and nothing can be a priori excluded from taking part in its formation. Cohesion is loose rather than tight. The formation of European identity no longer takes place in the city centers and is no longer controlled by those who occupy the center or issue symbols from it. Projects such as Grand Paris 2030 are significant of this development. Nicolas Sarkozy recently commissioned a group of architecture offices to project their boldest visions about the Parisian metropolitan region for the future. All of the offices focus on expanding the city and breaking the boundary between the city center and the outskirts. The French architect Christian de Portzamparc, hope I pronounced that correctly, offers a new metropolitan high-speed train running along the city ring. Others propose an unprecedented megacity as if to rival Sao Paulo or Mumbai, reaching all the way to the English Channel. With 20th century modern, and that means primitive, methods, Sarkozy's project hope to gain new control over the places where Europe's future identity is negotiated. But it remains unclear just how state and market, both impacted by the crisis, should finance the construction of the symbolic utopia without a new wealth boom being created. So just to repeat, European cities are no longer signified by centers. The meaning of European cities is defined by and at their peripheries, which may, but not necessarily need be their outskirts. And these borders may be between cultures, between networks, and between values. An identity arises from the confrontation of loyalties, social, cultural, and political, which occur in a shared space. Identity can never be stable and permanent, and therefore the real dispute is not over identity itself, but over which forces, which social and cultural groups are being allowed to influence it. In July 2006, the Swiss-based Islamic scholar and writer Tariq Ramadan, who you see here on the top left for you, published a manifesto for a new we. Ramadan released the paper on his website and in the Independent and Guardian newspapers. The manifesto for a new we is a call to European Muslims to embrace democratic and pluralist values, even in the face of rising xenophobia and right-wing populism in many European countries. Ramadan calls upon the grassroots society level to propose concrete alternatives based on critical citizenship. In the same year of 2006, Ramadan, who teaches at Oxford University here in England, was appointed guest professor at Erasmus University in Rotterdam. The chair was paid for by the City Hall. Ramadan was supposed to lecture on the issue, of identity and citizenship, and he was supposed to build bridges with local Islamic communities. In September of 2009, he was fired from his Rotterdam engagements because of his work for the Iranian television channel Press TV. The accusation was that instead of making Muslims more aware of Western values, instead Ramadan had begun to teach Islam in Rotterdam. But the essential fact of an information society is that information goes both ways. A short note on the design of Tariq Ramadan's website. The site is designed by OpenClick, an office from the northern Paris suburb of Saint-Denis. OpenClick has a wide variety of clients. One of its clients is in halal food chain. The site with its sleek, responsive tab navigation is elusively beautiful. There is something about both Ramadan as well as his website that seems just quite unclear and mysterious, but still very effective. Marco Pastors, who you see here on the right in a debate with Ramadan in Rotterdam, is a Rotterdam politician affiliated with the late Pim Fortuyn, blemished Ramadan for his costly engagements with little to no measurable integration as a net result. Ramadan, for many of his critics, is selling double talk or flexible dialectics, but his criticism is voiced with an agenda. Geert Wilders, the most visible representative of right-wing populism in Europe, has gained more visibility as an international diplomat than the Netherlands prime and foreign ministers together, with global speeches on Islam equaling Muslims with terrorists and comparing the Quran to Mein Kampf. The closed borders, zero-tolerance police state proposed by the populists prioritizes a community of legitimate stakeholders over the non-integrated outsiders. The legitimate community is united by race. Instead, Wilders claimed that it is united by the principle of freedom. The populist police state is a social welfare state, at least in its utopian form. It redistributes wealth on a first-come, first-served basis. Its social contract is not a neoliberal free-for-all, but a managed system of societal borders between first- and second-class citizens. So, to conclude, let's stay here. The conflict between Ramadan and his Rotterdam employees brings to the fore the dispute over what constitutes the intellectual heritage of Europe. The principle of dialogue is being exchanged for the idea of Western superiority. It is possible that, as Tariq Ramadan suggests, yesterday's closed society cohesion in Europe is a thing of the past. It is not about regaining it, but about exploring the new situation. A more fragmented type of model is already under development, which might mean that people have to curb some of their freedom to judge others out of respect for others. Or that is, as Badiou has said, all of the society jargon about communities is utter nonsense. Let people live the way they want to or can, eat what they are used to eating, wear turbans, dresses, hijabs, miniskirt or tap dancing shoes. What seems to be under pressure most is the principle of centrality. Instead, we see that conflict has to be reinvented as negotiation and argumentation, and the difference as a possibility and potential. All this happens in a Europe without compelling symbols, a brand without a center, that perhaps therefore is more advanced. The social and political future of Europe is, already for that reason, going to be entwined with the efforts of design and designers as long as these recognize the forces and influences around them. Thank you. Maybe you can leave it on.
It's coming.
Hi.
Hello. And thank you. I'm fascinated by your presentation of the idea of Europe as being an empty signifier, of being the generic, and all of these things. In that, on one hand, this is not untrue. Mm-hmm. That, you know, because you've given clear examples and you've set up a method that allows for this argument. However, it is also the same argument or the same methodology that power uses to allow itself to maintain its position. So ubiquity, invisibility, even to the point of derision. And it is at that point that things become highly specific. So because Europe cannot be named, cannot be identified, is the reason why people like Sarkozy, to use your example, can speak about a European identity which does not want to be tarnished by the introduction of Turkey. So, you know, on one hand, you say, so anyway, I'll stop. I'd like to respond.
I think you're right. What I was trying to say we were trying to explain is that all this talk about, Europe is not, the power in Europe is not distributed like, you know, in a pyramid, for instance, where there's one thing, you know, on top and then everything dribbles down. It's more like a pyramid without a top, basically, you know, like, what we think shows the collection of this of these brands and all these self-initiated projects, maybe that I was showing, you know, like people appropriating, manifesting Europe by designing it themselves, is that
what did I want to say? Is that there? You know, there's all this talk about trying to project an identity of Europe, which is compared a lot to branding or to the way that the U.S. Represents itself. But maybe in Europe there's a different kind of image construction that's much more about networking rather than about power.
Okay.
Is that clear? Maybe not.
Well, I'm sure that it will come out further as people raise their questions. Questions? Microphone? No, that was not a hand being raised. It was someone writing. Sorry?
There's one.
Ah, there's a question.
Thanks. Hi, Vinka.
Hi.
I have a couple of questions, but I'll just try and pick one. I was really interested in what partly falls into what Rami was saying, I guess, but in the kind of the use of euro to denote kind of cheapness.
Mm-hmm.
And the difference between the kind of visual representation of this euro brand as this kind of cheap brand and the kind of political potency of the concept of the European community or Europe, or Fortress Europe, and so on, as we've spoken of today. And I was just, in a sense that, for example, American things in America, you don't have that kind of the association with cheapness in terms of American products or produce. There's a sense of pride. And I wonder what you thought this cheap euro thing says about the concept of Europe as it currently stands.
Well, first of all, it's very funny when you start kind of looking for them because it's, you know, they're just everywhere, these brands. But I think the difference, a big difference between the American identity and the European is that European identity is something that's added to an already existing identity. So it's almost like someone in Holland called it like a washing label once, you know, like it's something that's added to something that already exists. And I think precisely because of the fact that no one can claim the real Europe, or like there's not been one image that we've been able to represent as being European, people can start appropriating it very easily. That's the open source aspect of it, which is also really fun, I think. You know, like there's a great sense of identification in that sense with much more than with the European flag and the stars and the word euro than maybe we think or the European Council tries to make us believe is the case.
Okay, the question here.
It's connected to what you were just talking. This idea of, you know, because Europe is for everyone, is for no one, or for everyone can claim it, or the other way around. But I'm interested in this thing of cheap, or inverted commas, cheap, because we know that any design, especially the cheap ones, actually been paid quite a lot of money to designers to make it look cheap. So, why do you think that then the euro, Europe, has been then taken in for this so-called cheap look, where it could have been taken for luxury or for various other things? When did that shift happen, and why? Can you maybe?
Well, first of all, I think it's very important to connect this to the to the idea of centrality, so that the fact that if you would brand something that's very expensive or very exclusive, or would try to kind of visualize this, it's centrally organized. So there's one person that's trying to kind of label this as being important from other things, and that's precisely what makes this euro so different from any other centrally organized brand. And then on the other hand, I think because of the unspecificness of it, in a sense, it's also easy to appropriate in different countries. For instance, the Euro Shopper, which is probably the kind of most well-known brand, which is which is a brand that sells like all kind of cheap, more cheap food and household products in supermarkets, it's distributed in 16 countries in Europe. But on the other hand, like this Euro paint or the Euro drink, you know, it's maybe not so well distributed on a large scale. So to come back to your point, I think it's precisely because there's no one saying why what is the exclusiveness of Europe, why these things can exist.
thank you for that presentation. My question actually picks up on Sonia's comment, together with something that I picked up from the presentation, and also on yours, Margaret. The thing is, within Europe, we've got all these nations, and each one, in a way, has got this flag, and the flag is such a like an important thing, in between brackets. So what I'm talking about is this kind of nationalism. But then again, there's such discrepancies within these countries, and so to get a united front, I think, is extremely difficult. More so than the United States, where the thing United Nations have been kind of together for that much longer. And from that, you know, and just to shorten my comment, from that I'd like to pick on something you said about borders within countries and the periphery of you know, how do you relate from the central or the centrality of the thing into the periphery and vice versa, and the borders that are created. I just would like you to maybe pick on that and say something else along those lines, because actually our project picks upon that as well, and obviously this will come up for discussion, I would have thought, and I'm rather interested in that, in the fact that, you know, this central thing then starts breaking up into, or rather it borders itself out, mm-hmm. And marginalizes.
Just one more first, another comment on these Euro brands, which also refers back to what you were saying. You know, like in the 70s, Europe was still, you know, an utopia. You see this in this Euro-style font that was designed, but in this Europe car, you know, there's a lot of other examples. Europe was still seen as something that, you know, that, something futuristic, something to be celebrated. And that has completely changed. I mean, the fact that Europe's so different, I think is shown by these brands, you know, like, but about the center and the periphery, I think, you know, you see more and more the centers of European cities are becoming more alike and much more, are becoming much more similar to each other than they are similar to their own peripheries. So what's going on there, you know, like, and how can we, you know, the fact that Sarkozy makes a plan where they, where he wants to connect the banlieue to the center of Paris is maybe interesting, but the means which, by the way he wants to do it, are so kind of old-fashioned and still based on the idea that, you know, it's a city that's completely, completely relies on Fordist workforce, not on virtual or internet workflow, which makes it, I think, a very unrealistic project.
Okay, we have time for one last question.
Maybe people in the back can also.
Yeah, anyone to the back.
The lady with the blonde hair has been.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, okay, yeah, very quickly. Nicola, just. No?
Sorry, the mic is going to the back.
Hi, only to ask you, because you've been working on, I mean, basically what we've been seeing is certain kind of a critique of the symbols and so on. As you being a graphic designer and an architect, have you given some alternative to it? Have you been thinking of creating something which creates a parallel or something that creates you, as you've been thinking, like a better solution for these symbols?
Well, This is one project we did. It's a stamp sheet about Europe. It's basically hijacking the European official identity by this word Europe. And it speaks about European commemoration. It's perforated not only straight as stamp sheets usually look, but also diagonal. So the result is you get a very fragmented Europe. And basically all the images that are featured are maybe images that don't speak about Europe in which the European Council would speak about Europe, but much more about, I mean, the way that we are discussing Europe here today. So, you know, migrants, people living in European countries but not holding European identity, you consider them Europeans, they're in there. The Eurofighter, which is kind of this completely failed European project, is also kind of is also featured here in the as well as other things. So that's one thing we do. Maybe I quickly. So it's called Blackmail, this project. And these are some other images. This was exhibited, but we're also sending it to European think tanks. So we're sending letters to European think tanks where we use these stamps. But basically it was for an exhibition, yeah.
Okay. Well, great. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.